car, I can see, I think it's like,
yeah, that's better? A little better.
Okay. All right, thanks Marcus and everyone for having me. Great to be here again. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of papers that have come out over the last year on this R-symmetric gauge mediation and the minimal R-symmetric supersymmetric standard model, or depending on who you are, Mr. SSM or Mrs. SM. And this is work that I'm doing with my old office mates, Supeng Ying, and also these guys, this paper that just came out a couple months ago, Santiago de Lopi Amigo, is a grad student, and Patty Fox, who's at Fermilab, and Eric Poppitz, who's at Toronto with me. So just a overall reminder of how these things work. Supersymmetry is this symmetry that we really like that pairs standard model Weyl fermions with spin zero bosons, and each boson with a Weyl fermion. This is the minimal model that we're interested in. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why we love it, right? It solves the gauge hierarchy problem because fermions and bosons have opposite contributions when you do the loops. So quantum corrections cancel in the Higgs sector, and this, you can have a TeV scale Higgs naturally. And there's a whole bunch of other things that can happen as well. Grand unification, potential dark matter candidates. There's beautiful theorems like the Coleman-Mandula theorem that says that this is the only way to extend the Poincaré algebra, etc. So string theory likes it. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why people have been interested in supersymmetry
over the last several decades.
The problem, of course, is that we don't see scalar electrons or fermionic gluons or any of the other supersymmetric partners of the standard model. And this can be resolved by that old trick of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So it turns out, if you stare at the calculations carefully, that the solution to the hierarchy problem is assured so long as all Susy breaking operators are soft, which basically just means that the scaling dimension is less than 4. So you can have mass terms and trilinear terms. You just can't have higher dimension operators. And then you still have quadratic divergences canceling. So naively, if you just take the standard model, double it, add a second Higgs in order to cancel anomalies and keep holomorphy, and write down all soft Susy breaking operators allowed by symmetries and satisfying the soft condition, you have the so-called minimal supersymmetric standard model. So what are these soft operators we can write down? They come in 4 families. One of them is you can write down Hermitian scalar masses. This is Q star Q. These are the squarks or the sleptons. And these I and J are flavor indices. And this is a real or Hermitian scalar mass matrix. You can also write down holomorphic mass, where this is HH, not H star H. And these go under the name of B terms. But it turns out that the gauge symmetries are very strong. They constrain the MSSM to only have one such operator, and it involves the Higgs, and this is it. So there's only one B term in the MSSM. You can also have trilinear couplings that, again, are holomorphic. And these go by the name A terms. And there, again, gauge symmetry is very restrictive. The only thing you can have is H, Q left, squark right. And again, these IJs are flavor indices. And these As are now complex matrices, not Hermitian. They don't have to be Hermitian. And finally, we have Majorana gauge unomasses. Since every gauge boson gets paired with a Weyl fermion, the only mass you can make that's gauge invariant is a Majorana mass. So with all these new operators, the MSSM has a total of 124 parameters, and that's the minimal model. So needless to say, this is not good news. Many of these parameters are flavor mixing angles and phases, which means that naively you're going to have very large flavor changing neutral currents and CP violation. And this goes under the sort of generic name of the Susy flavor puzzle or the Susy flavor CP puzzle. So we need some principle to eliminate all this flavor violation to avoid conflict with observation and reducing parameter space so that experimentalists can tell us something. So this was the motivation for all those many types of Susy that you've seen, gauge mediation, gravity mediation. But recently a new proposal has come out involving what's called an R-symmetry. So an R symmetry is any symmetry that rotates fields within a supermultiplet differently. So the fermion and the boson have different charges under the symmetry group. So the Z2R parity is one example of that. It's the one probably everyone is familiar with, where the fermion is odd, is even usually, and the scalar is odd in the case of the fermions in the standard model. But in general, this doesn't have to be a Z2. It can be anything. Cribbs, Pappas, and Weiner wrote a paper last December where they found, somewhat surprisingly, that if you impose an additional R symmetry to the MSSM, something more than the Z2, they use the U1, as I'll show you in a minute. By imposing this additional R symmetry, you can actually have sizable flavor-violating operators while not generating large flavor-changing neutral currents or CP violation, as long as the gluinos are heavy. That's one very important constraint. So in everything that they did and everything I did, we impose a U1R symmetry, but a discrete symmetry would work as well. A Z4 would do okay. A Z6 would forbid operators that come from Suzy Guts, but the Z2 was not enough. The Z2 is what the MSSM has. So you need something bigger than that. So we're just going to do a U1. So features of this minimal R symmetric, supersymmetric standard model. Okay, first of all, there are no Majorana masses anymore for the Gaginos, but you can potentially write down Dirac masses. So normally you think if there's no Majorana mass for the Gagino, then you're already ruled out. But it turns out that you can write down Dirac masses, so you're not in trouble yet. There's no A terms for the scalars. Those will also violate these R symmetries. And with no A terms, it means no left-right squarks lepton mixing, and that's a very important point in order to reduce the number of operators that you can write down in a low energy. That's one of the reasons why you can keep the constraints under control. And also, it turns out there's no mu term. You can't write that down, but there is a B term. So that tells you that the Higgs sector is going to be very complicated compared to the MSSM Higgs sector. And I'll have more to say about this at the end of the talk. This is sort of work in progress. So what Cribbs, Pappas, and Weiner showed in their paper was that the strongest constraint in the Suzy flavor physics comes from KK bar mixing. So we parameterize the mixing of the left and right-handed squarks in terms of these delta lefts and delta rights. This is standard notation, where M12 is the off-diagonal down-strange squark mass, and the M-squark squared is some universal scalar mass that we do everything. We assume that the left and right-handed squarks have the same M, denominator here. This isn't a very strong assumption. You can allow those M's to be different. You wouldn't really change anything quantitatively. And the low energy effective action is then given by this formula. And there are two very important things to notice. First of all, normally in the MSSM, these operators come with a 1 over m gluino squared contribution. But now it's going like m squark squared over m gluino to the fourth. So there's a stronger suppression here as long as we make the gluinos very heavy. That was the argument I was saying before, that the gluinos have to be heavy. So that's one thing to note. And the other important thing is that I didn't make a mistake, but I'm missing two operators here, 01, 04, 05. What happened to 02 and 03? And the reason that they're not there is because the only way you can generate 02 and 03 at this order in perturbation theory is with A terms. And since the A terms were forbidden, those two operators do not get generated at this order, at the one loop order. And QCD corrections to this was all shown in Cribbs, Pappas, and Weiner, and then I wrote a paper with Supeng Ng earlier in the year where we did the QCD corrections to this model. And this is what we found. So this axis here is the gluino mass, and this axis here is the squark mass. This goes in units of TeV, so this is 2TeV, 4TeV, 6TeV, 8TeV, 10TeV. And this goes in units of hundreds of GeV, so 200, 400, 600, 800, 1,000 GeV. Okay? The dotted lines correspond to no QCD corrections, and the solid lines include the QCD corrections at one loop, doing a leading log approximation. And here we always said delta left equal to delta right. That's sort of the maximal worst case scenario. You can make one of the deltas smaller. That will only make things better. So here, let's just look at this one. This is probably the most revealing. Everything above the solid line is allowed. So this is all the excluded region in the KK bar mixing plane, and this is the allowed region. So in particular, you can see for like 500 or 600 GeV squarks, we can get 5 to 6 TeV gluinos. So that gives you an idea that typically you need a factor of about 5 to 10 in that ratio in order to get this to work. And this is for delta left and delta right equal to 1. This plot here is a little strange because, of course, when deltas go to 1, then the mass insertion approximation breaks down. So these formulas, these plots really don't mean anything. There is some work going on right now. I believe Neil Weiner and Alex Kagan sent me an email that they were doing this where delta is 0.8, and they were doing it outside the mass insertion approximation, and they still showed there's a sizable region of parameter space where this model works. So it seems that this really is a generic solution to the Suzy flavor puzzle. The other thing we can look at in the kaon sector is CP violation. Unfortunately, the model doesn't do quite as well over there. Here, we take 2 points with a gluino mass of 3.5 TeV and the squark mass of 400 GeV. That's an allowed point. Delta left and delta right, we chose to be these. These are all points that were done by Cribbs, Poppets, and Weiner, and they calculated the phase in delta left to be 0.15 and 0.01 radians. And when we went ahead and did QCD corrections, we found you can get as much as a factor of 10 constraint on those without the QCD correction. So the model doesn't do very well for CP violation, unfortunately, but it does help with KK bar mixing.
Could you just go back for a second?
Sure.
I just wanted to understand how those numbers relate to your statement. So the KPW phase is...
This is without the QCD corrections.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Cribbs, Poppets, Weiner result. Okay. So naively, you would expect if you had a solution to the flavor puzzle, these phases should be order one.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and what we find is that when you include the QCD corrections in the Wilson, you know, coefficients, right,
mm-hmm.
then you need to get that phase much smaller in order to keep epsilon k within the standard models.
But it's in this framework, it's natural. There's nothing because these are Dirac gay genos. There's nothing wrong with making the gay geno masses even heavier, is there? There's no naturalness problem in making them heavier. Usually there is, because they get contributed one loop to ordinary masses, right? But with a log. But here they don't have a log, so they're actually the corrections are a lot smaller.
But does that improve the problem?
Yeah, because...
Well, if you make the gay genos very heavy.
Yeah.
Right, so...
That means
good,
that
that's a good point. So with the constraint of you wanting TeV scale gluinos, so that you might see them at the LHC, then I think
I
can understand.
Yeah,
right.
But I mean, I'm like in the normal MSSM, there's no naturalness problem in making these quite a bit higher. In fact, if you made them as high as 10 TeV, you'd still be okay. That would be the
So what
the
would happen to
super
those
soft,
numbers
super
if they were 10 TeV?
The amplitude goes like 1 over m gluino to the 4th. So if you double them, then the coefficients would change by a factor of 16.
So
that probably would improve these things a lot more, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have a comment about the super soft thing in a minute. But are there any questions up to that point? That's what I'm going to say about what had come before. Okay. Now, fortunately, there's a problem with this story that I glossed over, which is anytime you spontaneously break supersymmetry, you have a Goldsteino and a cosmological constant, and when you turn on supergravity, you can see that Goldsteino is eaten by the gravitino, and it gains a mass, which is R-violating in the normal n equals 1 Suzy story. And this mass term, this gravitino mass, feeds into the MSSM through anomaly mediation. So it looks like this model can never be realized. If you have, you talk about imposing an R symmetry, but you can never turn off anomaly mediation. It's always there. So a solution that we were thinking about over the summer, gauge mediation has a very light gravitino typically, typically around a KeV. So that would basically make these all these effects irrelevant. So you still have anomaly mediation, but it would be very small. It would be loop suppressed from a KeV. So all of those effects would be under control. And you can still talk about an R symmetry. So ordinary gauge mediation breaks the R symmetry, but if we can find a framework where we can maintain the symmetry through a gauge mediation-like mechanism, then we might be able to realize MRSSM naturally. And that was our motivation for what we ended up doing. So there's already a sort of a models that existed that accidentally did this anyway. ISS, the Interrogator Seiberg and Shi models that came out in the fall of 2006, they showed that certain SUSY QCD theories have a metastable vacuum that spontaneously breaks supersymmetry but preserves an R symmetry. In these models, they're SUSY QCD models, so the electric theory, or the UV theory, has NF quark superfields and an SUNC gauge group and a superpotential that is given by that. And then the magnetic theory, which is the sort of the low energy theory, has a meson superfield, NF dual quark superfields, and an SUNF minus NC gauge group. And the effective superpotential looks like this, where you can write down higher dimension operators that we don't. Okay. So over the last couple of years, a lot of work has gone into finding ways to break the R symmetry so as to give the gauginos Majorana masses. Because in order to make the model viable, everyone thought that you needed to have masses for the gauginos. And we have a whole bunch of references in our paper. So in everything we did, we considered NF equals 6 and NC equals 5 as the simplest model. So in such a case, you have pure confinement in the magnetic theory and no gauge fields left over. And this model was considered by Chaki, Sherman, and Turning almost immediately after ISS came out. And in addition, in this model, the dual squarks get VEVs. And those VEVs break SU6 down to SU5. So the low energy theory has an SU5 global symmetry and no additional gauge symmetry.
Sorry, what is a dual squark?
Oh, it's the usual Seiberg duality story where you have these quarks in the electric theory and then you want to write down a theory in the low energy that reproduces the anomalies and... Right. So that's all I mean. Okay, since we break SU6 to SU5, it's convenient to write everything in terms of SU5 superfields. So that SU6 adjoint, we can write as a SU5 adjoint, and a singlet, and a 5 and a 5 bar. And the dual squarks, we can write as a 5 and a singlet of this SU5. And similarly, the anti-squark has a 5 bar and a singlet, a different singlet, which we call psi bar. And also this capital M also has a singlet in it. The trace of M is also in it. Okay, so this is just a chart that says what I just said. This script M has an R charge of 2, if you look at the old superpotential. So therefore, all of these fields have R charge 2, and then all of these have R charge 0. So that's where these come from. And in what we're going to do, we're going to embed the standard model group as a gauged subgroup of SU5. So the standard model lives inside of this SU5 global symmetry. And in addition to all this, we add two additional adjoints. We add this capital phi, which is only an adjoint under the standard model gauge group. And this is the thing that's going to generate Dirac masses for the gauginos. And we'll see that happen explicitly in a minute. You can make it a full SU5. There's no reason in principle why you can't. But then you have these bachelor fields, and they can contribute pretty badly to the running of QCD and on the standard model. So we don't include... Also, you have to keep track of them. So we just don't include them. It's the minimal model. This M prime is an adjoint of the full SU5. And the reason we need that is because we have to marry it with this M so that the fermions can get a mass. Otherwise, the fermions living in this M will be massless to all orders in perturbation theory. And to have massless colored objects would be quite a problem. So the symmetry was SU6 to SU5. That was the breaking pattern. So there are 11 massless Nabu-Goldstone modes, and they have electroweak and QCD charge. So we need to get rid of them and make them heavy somehow. So what do? We tilt the ISS superpotential to explicitly break the SU6 symmetry and give masses to these modes, just like the pions and the masses of the quarks can tilt the pion chiral Lagrangian. So now the superpotential has two terms, this W magnetic prime and this W1. W magnetic prime, should be a prime here, is exactly the W magnetic I wrote before, written out in terms of the SU5 objects instead of the SU6 objects. And now I insert these tilting parameters everywhere that I can. So here I normalize things so that this coefficient of this operator is just lambda, the overall lambda. And then I can have a kappa prime here and a kappa here. And there's a symmetry I'll show you in a minute where these two couplings have to be the same. And here this is the F squared is basically the Suzy breaking scale. And here I can put a relative tilting parameter between these two terms as well. And W1 is a new term that you can write down that obeys all the symmetries that involve this standard model adjoint superfield. And this minus sign here is pretty cute, but it turns out that it doesn't really, it's not physical, but I'll show you where that comes from in a minute. Okay? So at the Suzy breaking metastable vacuum, a couple of things get VEVs. The singlets, the product of singlets, get a VEV, which is proportional, which is equal to F squared over lambda kappa prime, where kappa prime, remember, is that tilting parameter. And the trace of M's F term gets a VEV as well, proportional to omega F squared. So we can parameterize all the masses in terms of two dimensionless variables and a single mass. There's this X, which is not really going to appear in anything else. There's this Z, which, notice the Z is the ratio of the three tilting parameters that we had, okay, omega, kappa prime, and kappa squared. And then the messenger mass is proportional to the ratio of these two numbers times F squared. And notice that the Suzy breaking comes from the omega part, and X over Z has no omega dependence, so this messenger mass is not Suzy breaking. So first, the scalar ends, those are the things that came from that large adjoint, the 5 and 5 bar, they get Suzy-preserving mass squares proportional to M messenger squared. And this is what I was saying, that this is not a Suzy-breaking mass. The 5s, the parts of the dual squarks, they get Suzy-breaking mass squares that go like 1 plus or minus Z times M messenger. Remember that Z, again, is that ratio of tilting parameters. So when Z goes to 1, which is when all those tilting parameters are equal, then you get a massless mode here. And these are the Goldstone modes of the SU6 to 5 breaking. Okay? But an important point is that unlike an ordinary gauge mediation, these masses are R-preserving. And the fermions, they're Dirac fermions now that involve phi and n bar mixing rather than phi phi bar mixing like ordinary gauge mediation. And these have a Suzy preserving Dirac mass and messenger, which is the same as this and obeys the usual sum rule. And another thing that's going to be important in what follows, since we've added all of these fields, and they all have charges under the standard model, we're going to get a Landau pole from this. So QCD will develop a Landau pole. The other fields, the other SU2 and U1 will also get Landau poles, but at much higher scales. So this is the one we have to keep track of. So that's something important. All right, this isn't that important. It's just to complete the story. The singlets, psi and psi bar, they also get, remember, the product got a VEV. So we can parameterize them in terms of these etas and xis. A Coleman-Weinberg one-loop calculation gives eta equals 0. And the Xi is the 11th Goldstone, Nabu-Goldstone boson of this leftover U1 symmetry that I didn't bother to talk about because it's not really that important. W1 explicitly breaks the symmetry, those terms that involve the capital phi. So they will generate a potential for the Nambu-Goldstone boson at two loops. And this is the loop, and here's the potential, and it's a negative cosine potential, so it's stabilized at C equals zero. And here's the mass. It's proportional to loop factors times the messenger mass. We're not going to use this in anything else, but this may be, there's a bunch of things. It may be a dark matter candidate. It may be, who knows?
It's a singlet, so.
All right. The other thing is that there's an additional symmetry that I hadn't mentioned yet, which is just the ordinary charge conjugation symmetry, that symmetry from CPT, that one. That symmetry exchanges barred and unbarred fields. It changes fives with five bars. It also changes the sign of the gauge field, just like the ordinary, you know, it's the ordinary story. The photon goes from minus the photon. So in order to make a Dirac mass, we're going to choose the adjoint phi to also be odd under this charge conjugation symmetry. And this is where that minus sign comes from in W1, because otherwise that term wouldn't be invariant. So this does a couple of things for us. First of all, it forbids a tadpole for the hypercharge adjoint up to standard model contributions that we assume are small. There's this famous result by Bagger, Poppitz, and Randall that say that when you have a singlet, you can generally destabilize the hierarchy by generating a tadpole for that singlet at two loops. But this symmetry then forbids that from happening. The thing, of course, to remember is that charge conjugation symmetry is broken in the standard model because of the electroweak sector and the Yukawa sector as well. So there are potentially terms that are going to be generated proportional to those couplings, but they're all quite small. And for this result, you just need the cutoff to be about 10 to the 11 GeV, and you're still okay. So with these small couplings, that's the size of that tadpole is already under control. It's not Planck scale. The other thing this does is it forbids kinetic mixing of the Suzy breaking spurion, which behaves sort of like a gauge field, with the hypercharged D term. Such a thing would generate tachyonic sleptons, and that would, of course, be a disaster. This is a famous problem of the so-called super soft models, where you have Dirac gauge genome masses, and this symmetry forbids this from happening as well.
So just a question, so do you... You had a Landau pole at lambda 3. Are you
right.
only considering this theory below
yes.
lambda 3?
Yes, right. We're only going to consider it up to some cutoff. Mm-hmm. And in fact, to be correct, it should be lambda 3 over 4 pi. Right. So we want to be
and
below that scale.
That's the number that's this 10 to the 11th? Or is that a different number?
Oh, about the tadpole?
Yeah.
The tadpole is just this two-loop supergravity contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So naively, you think it's Planck scale, and that destabilizes the hierarchy. That's what Bagger, Poppitz, Randall showed in the 90s. And what we find, what we really need is that cutoff should be no larger than 10 to the 11 GeV. That's what that was saying. This Landau pole is much lower than that. But the thing you might worry about is that since you have a singlet, supergravity will generate this tadpole at two loops,
mm-hmm.
but they would be proportional to whatever breaks the charge conjugation symmetry, which are small Yukawa couplings and gauge couplings. So already the tadpole is going to be suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be Planck scale. So that's a different question. But, right. Okay, so now let's try and generate a spectrum. And in order to do it, there are two contributions that have to be tracked, and this gets to what you were just saying. First, because we have a Landau pole, we have a cutoff in the theory that's not that far above the weak scale. It's going to be something like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 GeV. So it's still way above, you know, the electroweak sector, but it's not Planck scale or Gut scale. So we can generate physics above that scale can generate lower dimension, IR operators, and we have to keep track of what those are. And we'll do that with naive dimensional analysis, basically. And in particular, there's no reason to assume that whatever this unknown physics is, it's flavor symmetric. So this is where the flavor violation can happen. Normally, gauge mediation solves the flavor puzzle by just everything's flavor universal because it's gauge interactions. But now we want to allow for there to be non-zero flavor mixing, because that's MRSSM's claim to fame, right? And this is where that mixing is going to come from. And of course, the other contribution is the gauge, is the gauge-mediated contribution, what we call the IR contribution. It's going to be a little different than ordinary gauge mediation, as I'll show you in a few slides, but it's very similar. So first, the UV contributions. Every term can be generated from a Susie breaking spurion, which is just the VEV of that trace of M. Right? So if you write it in terms of super space language, it's theta squared times this omega F squared. And it turns out, when you stare at it, all of the UV contributions turn out to be proportional to a single mass scale, which is given by this formula. When you write it in terms of those couplings I showed you before, it's Z over lambda, which is some order one number, times M messenger squared over this lambda, where lambda is the scale at which these UV operators will be generated, something like lambda 3 over 4 pi. Okay. And this is just something that comes out of the analysis as you look at it. So if we want all of these MUV should be of order TeV or so, so that they're contributing to an electroweak scale physics, and we can see them at the LHC. So that gives you an idea. We have to see what parameters M messenger and lambda can be. So there are two extremes for estimating this lambda. One thing we can do is we can sort of go back to the ordinary gauge mediation story and say that nothing interesting happens at lambda 3. No flavor violation happens there. It all is up at the Planck scale. This would be it's like a minimal flavor violating hypothesis, for example, where we just say, okay, there's just no flavor violation anywhere up to the Planck scale. If that happens, the UV operators don't do anything for you. They don't generate any flavor violation. And so you're not going to realize this MRSSM wish list story where you can get delta to be close to 0.1. So for the sake of what we're doing, we're just not going to consider this case. But of course, if you believe in minimal flavor violation, for example, there's nothing wrong with this idea. The other extreme is to say what I was saying to Jack a few seconds ago, that lambda goes like lambda 3 over 4 pi. The 4 pi is just naive dimensional analysis, and we just say, okay, we have a cutoff. We'll just do 4 pi times the cutoff. Now, that's where everything gets strung. It's the usual story. This is sort of the maximal size of these operators. It's the lowest value lambda can get naturally. You can always make it lower, but this is sort of naturally where you'd expect it to be, naively expect it to be. Well, so we're going to consider this as the case, but remember, it could actually be an overestimation. That is, lambda can actually be bigger than this. For example, you might think, well, flavor violation doesn't involve QCD, right? It only involves the Higgs and electroweak physics, so maybe there should be Yukawas and G primes and things like that floating around here that would make this lambda even bigger. Or this white lambda 3 should actually be a lambda 2, because it's the actual, it's SU2 that's getting strong that should be important. So these are all, you know, words. In reality, of course, we don't know what the theory looks like above lambda 3, so we just said, okay, this is the minimal thing we can do. But keep in mind that we could potentially imagine a situation if we try and write the dual model above lambda 3, there might be a theory where this lambda could actually be much larger. So it's just something to keep in mind. We're going to keep it as conservative as we can. So UV contributions. First, the Dirac-Agino. This is the operator involving UV physics. Okay. If you go ahead and do the superspace integration, you find that it's proportional to MUV over lambda. So if this is something like TeV and this is something like 10 to the 3 TeV, you see that this is a small contribution. And so the gauge mediation contribution is going to be of order TeV, right? So if you want MUV to be TeV as well, and then this lambda's lambda 3 over 4 pi, so that's something like 10 to the 3 TeV. So this contribution is suppressed. So the gay genome mass doesn't get any noticeable contribution from the UV physics. The scalars, on the other hand, do. Here's the operator that generates them, and here you can see this is an easy superspace integral to do. You get Mij is proportional to MuV, where these Ijs are flavor indices, and these Cs here are presumably order one numbers that are matrices in flavor space. If you want this to be a solution to the flavor puzzle, these Cs should all be order one, and you'd have an anarchic scenario. So this is what we would like to have happen. Then at last, you also have these adjoints. Their scalars can also get masses. And here's that, what I was telling you about before, where the fermions of this adjoint M have to get a mass, and that happens from an operator like this. Okay. So now the IR contributions. The Dirac A genome mass, there's a new diagram that's not there for ordinary gauge mediation. Here we have the gauginos coming in, and the adjoint superfield is going in, fermion of the superfield is going in here. And here we have one messenger loop. And this scalar piece here has Suzy breaking in it, just like ordinary gauge mediation. But unlike ordinary gauge mediation, this has an R-preserving mass instead of an R-violating mass. So that's a big difference. And again, notice that we have this N phi, N capital phi, var phi. So that's that W1 vertex that I showed you before. So this diagram gives this formula for N half. Notice it's not, in gauge mediation, it would be g squared over 16 pi squared, but now it's gy over 16 pi squared. It's proportional to this messenger mass and this function of r of z, which we call r of z, which is similar but not the same as the usual gauge-mediated one-loop function. There's also this cosine of xi, but remember, xi was stabilized at zero, so this cosine is just one. The IR contribution to the scalar masses are no different than ordinary gauge mediation, with one little catch. Even though we have two vector-like fundamentals, right, the phi phi bar and the nn bar, only the phi phi bar contributes because the n's had Suzy preserving masses. So the n's, the two loop diagrams cancel. Only the phi contributes. So that's just a cute little story. This formula comes right out of your favorite Suzy textbook. And this is the ordinary, this is just the usual gauge mediation two loop diagram answer.
Can you just remind me why, if you generate two loop scalar masses from the usual diagrams, why you don't generate Majorana masses at the same order? Majorana Gaugino masses?
At two loops?
No, at one loop.
You need
rise to a mass.
Yeah,
a
you
mass
need. Ordinarily, you have something like this, and then you have a scalar with an insertion with an F-term insertion up here, and this breaks. If it's ordinary gauge mediation, this object would break.
So you just don't have a scalar F term? Is that what you?
Yeah.
Is that what you have?
That's right. You don't have a scalar F term.
You don't have the scalar F term.
Right. This is a Suzy. This is not a Suzy. This is not a R symmetry breaking mass for the scalar. It's only an R. It's an R preserving but Suzy breaking mass.
But that mass, the fermion mass, then is.
So R diagram looks like this. So you can have a phi. And then this is the phi, and then n. So this Dirac mass goes phi to n, but there's no scalar that turns a phi scalar to an n scalar. Mm-hmm. There's no interaction that turns a phi scalar to an n scalar. Mm-hmm. So there'd be no vertex here to make a lambda coming out.
Can you just remind me what your Lagrangian looks like? Just the, what does the superpotential terms look like in this theory?
The important superpotential has something like an M messenger times phi bar n plus n bar phi. And there's also a theta squared.
The messenger has a theta squared. Oh, theta's okay.
But no, no one for the n.
Okay.
So, there's no. If this is a lambda and this is a lambda, then there's no way to connect this in a momentum independent way.
Second.
Okay, so scalars, the squarks and sleptons, they're the usual story, but with only one messenger instead of two, even though naively it looks like we have two. The adjoint scalars, as Marcus pointed out to me at Fermilab, also have mass coming from gauge mediation, and these are given at one loop, which is very interesting because that means that their scalar masses at one loop, so they're bigger than you would have naively thought. Normally you'd think scalar mass squared at two loop, but here it's at one loop. And it's proportional to this u power squared over 16 pi squared, it's proportional to this messenger, and these functions of the Suzy breaking are is the same R that you got from the gauge mediation, the gaugino mass, and R sub s is a similar function, it's a little different. 1 plus z becomes 1 plus z squared, basically. So it's almost the same. And, m phi is a real mass, and b phi, remember what that meant, was it's a phi phi mass term. It's a holomorphic mass for the phi.
So what is the diagram for m phi squared?
There's a whole bunch. But, for example, you can have a phi... this phi, right, the thing that marries the gaugino, and you can have an n fermion and a phi bar fermion. So it's basically, take this diagram and replace this vertex with this vertex. And arrange fields in a way to get it. And you get both a B term and a real term, depending on how you get your arrows to go. Okay, so this leads to a more or less robust prediction that the adjoint scalar, the ratio of the scalar mass to the gaugino mass, and the ratio of the B term mass to the gaugino mass is square root of 4 pi over alpha. You just take this formula and the previous one and plug it in. So in particular, actually the smaller alpha is, the larger the scalar gets. So the QCD adjoint scalar should be the lightest one. And also another sort of funny prediction is that both these numbers are the same order, as you can see, because these are very similar functions. And also, it turns out that B is always negative for any value of Z. It's always safe because you'll never get you can have M squared plus B and M squared minus B, but you'll never get one of those being negative. So B is always strictly, the magnitude of B is always strictly less than the magnitude of M phi squared, as you can see by just looking at this formula carefully. So there's no tachyons living here, but B being always negative means that the scalar is going to be the lighter of the two particles. The scalar will be lighter than the pseudoscalar, at least from this contribution. Okay, now we just put into typing what I just said. N phi squared is of order b absolute value, and b is always negative, so scalar is lighter than the superscalar. So the adjoint scalars are typically very heavy, because all these things are one-loop contributions proportional to the messenger mass. This could have consequences for the low-energy spectrum, since the scalars can contribute to the Fermi, the other scalar runnings at two loop, and this is something Marcus was telling me about at Fermilab. So this is potentially a very interesting question, and we're thinking about it with Santiago, the grad student, and I'd be happy to talk to people about what we've been looking at. There's also interesting phenomenology in its own right. These scalars are, you know, new. They're more or less robust additions to any model that has Dirac Geno's. You could potentially have single production of the scalars through gluon fusion, since the scalar gluino, if you will, is the lightest one. So that might be an interesting Tevatron signal, something that we were thinking about with Dave Kaplan when I was still a grad student. It's hard, but you know, it could be done. Also, recently a paper came out by Tillman Plain and Tim Tate where they did double production at the LHC if these things are light enough. Unfortunately, by light enough, they mean TeV, and it doesn't look very easy to get these things into TeV, but, you know, it's still potentially very interesting. So, we have ordinary scalar gauge-mediated masses, but a new kind of gauge genome mass. But remember that the MRSSM needed the gauge genomes heavier than the Swarks by a factor of 5. 10 would probably be even better, but we can get away with 5. However, if you just take the ratio of m half to m zero, just looking at the IR contribution, ignoring the UV for a second, you get this formula. And this ratio, r over square root of f, is strictly less than 1. Is strictly less than 1 for any value of z. So this is bad news for us, because it means that the Gugino is always naively going to be heavier than the, would like to be lighter than the scalar, if you only look at IR contributions.
But why are you comparing to the IR contribution of the scalar? I mean, first of all, the IR, could you live without the UV contribution?
That's what we would like to see. If you want to have order 0.1 deltas, then this is telling you that you can't.
You want the UV one because you want flavor violation?
Yes. Right.
You could also not have flavor violation.
Yes. And then there's no problem at all. Right. So from the point of view of trying to realize MRSSM's solution to the flavor puzzle, we would like this ratio to be 5, and it's less than 1 right now. We can have UV contributions to push this up, but since we don't have any control over those, because they're just coming from numbers that we don't know how to calculate in, right? We want to see if the IR contribution could do it on its own, but it doesn't look like it can, unless Y becomes very big. So that's the question. But you're right that if you're willing to, if you would like to look at that first scenario I showed you before, where lambda's M Planck, that is, there's no flavor violation in, you know, anywhere until you hit, you know, the gut scale or the Planck scale, then there's nothing wrong with any of this. It's a new form of gauge mediation and potentially very interesting. But we would like to go a step further and see if we can still have sizable flavor violation and use the MRSSM to solve the problem. Okay. The other thing that we wanted to do is we can generalize all of this. Everything that we have been doing has always been within the context of these ISS models. So we had all these additional adjoints. Notice we never used them. They were just there. We don't really like them because naively they have massless fermions. They also lower the Landau pole of QCD because two SU5 adjoints give a contribution of 10 to the beta function in QCD. Right? So they're sort of troublesome. They don't really help us. So you can ask, do we really need them? And the thing to remember is that when generating all of this spectrum, we had a Susie-breaking and R-preserving messenger scalar mass and an R-preserving chirality flip in the fermions.
That was what we needed.
So we can seek to capture those two things in a more general model that removes the excess baggage. And here is what we came up with. So you have this is the Susie-breaking piece, where this C, remember, is theta squared F squared. Okay. This messenger mass, just this thing. And then these Yukawas, which you needed in order to get gauge genome masses. Okay? So less adjoints means that the QCD land-up hole can be higher, and that gives us a little better control of UV operators. And is also good news for anyone who wants to construct a dual model of this theory, because right now lambda 3 being so low is This model also has a new parameter, which is the number of these messengers. Right? You could have as many of them as you want, in principle. Both the gauge genome mass and the squark mass squared have are contributions proportional to n messenger, so the ratio would go like square root of n messenger. So we can make the ratio big again if we make n messenger large. Of course, if we make n messenger too large, then we're right back to where we started. We'll get a low Landau pole again. But it turns out that it's a much slower effect than including adjoints. And even an M messenger of about 5 or 6 still makes the situation better than having the adjoints. Okay? So now let's consider, okay, I'm going to move along. Let's consider three spectra and see how we do. We have an ISS model with a small Yukawa, an ISS model with a large Yukawa, and this generalized model that I just showed you. And everything we do, all the scalar masses I show you are just IR contributions. So remember, the UV contribution is added. So you can keep that in the back of your mind. And we use the parameters Z is 0.99, lambda is 1, and all other couplings are order 1. The Z.99 is not really a tuning. The reason why we did Z.99 is because it makes the non-computerized calculation a little easier. There's nothing very special about it. Remember, it was the ratio of three of those tilting parameters. So you can make this Z, you know, you can change it if you don't like 0.99, you can make it 0.9 or even 0.8. But you want it to be close to 1 because you want the Susie breaking to be sizable. Okay, so for small Yukawas, by which I mean Y is 2, the Landau pole is roughly a 10 to the 4 TeV, and you see that we're in trouble from the point of view of the MRSSM, because the squark mass is only 1400 GeV, and the gluino mass is 880. So this is the problem, that one is, you know, it's the wrong way. You want this one to be 5 times heavier, it's actually twice as light. So, again, this is a totally viable spectrum, but it doesn't realize MRSSM. We can make it realize MRSSM, or try to make it realize MRSSM. Here we have a situation where the squarks are 1300 GeV and the gluino is 3500 GeV. Ah, much better. But at what cost? We had to pump Y all the way up to 8. So that's not a reasonable solution. This is... Yeah, you don't even want to trust these numbers at this point. But the only reason why I keep this slide is because I want to show you that the only way that we seem to be able to generate the MRSSM's solution to the flavor puzzle is by going to strong coupling. So this tells us something about these models. Finally, the generalized models we do much better with the Yukawa 3, which isn't too bad, and an N messenger of 6, the QCD Landau pole is at 5 times 10 to the 4. The Y Yukawa Landau pole is roughly the same order. It's a little smaller, but it's roughly about 10 to the 4. And the squarks are at 1900 GeV, and the gluinos are at 5300 GeV. So this does much better. It's about 2.5. We need 5, but remember, there's also the IR contributions. So that could help us along as well. So it looks like the generalized model is much better at realizing MRSSM than ISS was.
But in a spectrum like this, you're never going to see the
Not directly, no. But.
But that's a property of the MRSSM, not your model, right? I mean, there is.
Yeah, the MRSSM.
You could have gotten other numbers. These are just some examples, right? Mm-hmm. You could have gotten lower values for the Guarino mass. But
I mean, you can scale down the messenger mass if you like and get these things a little lighter. You can chain.
What's the lightest Guarino mass that you would say solves the flavor problem by this mechanism?
In this mechanism, it's about 3 or 4 TeV is about as good as you can get, which is not good news for the LHC. So, yeah, I think that at this point, the Guarinos are not, if you believe in this mechanism, the Guarinos will not be seen at the LHC.
And therefore, none of the other regions either. I mean, you would usually make the others just by cascade decaying into them, so you're not going to make those that way, probably. So you wouldn't be able to see any of the gay genos to check any of these ideas.
Yeah, it would be a... Yeah, I don't know how you would do it.
Okay, so then squarks.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, but the squarks are light.
I'm just looking at this spectrum, so
right.
There's a spectrum
I see.
Here.
The squarks are always
this
light.
The spectrum here, you wouldn't be able to make them. But yeah, if somehow the Reno and Dinos were light enough, you could make it to make a cascade decays.
From squarks, right.
From squarks, but I don't see that happening here. I mean, that would be interesting if there was a spectrum that you could check some of these ideas experimentally.
Well, I mean, go back to the model that we didn't like, and it does just fine. You know, I mean, 800 to 14, you can generate these just great. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't know if you can realize MRSSM and get a good spectrum. We tried a bunch, but... Okay, so now that we have a model, and we've generated it to some extent, we want to know how tuned it actually is. There are two types of tuning that we can consider. One is that in order to make the squarks light, there has to be a UV-IR cancellation. Even the best case scenario, remember, that I just showed you, had the ratio only about 2 to 2.5, and we needed 5. So we still, even in the best case scenario, we have to have a UV-IR cancellation. So we have to see how natural that is. And the other thing is that in order to satisfy all the flavor constraints, there's still a tuning of those deltas coming from the UV contribution. Remember, we wanted the deltas to be all the same order at 0.1. So we have to see how good we actually can do to get that. So first, the UV-IR cancellation. So recall those that MUV, right, goes like M messenger squared over capital lambda, times this CD, where D is for diagonal, because we're only looking at the overall masses, not the flavor-violating part. So if M0 is the physical mass, right, let's say you want to make the squarks 500 GeV, okay, whatever they are, so then you can write down a formula for what CD has to be in terms of this physical mass and the IR contribution and the MU and the UV contribution. And that's just, you know, summings the squares to get the right number. And so for the ISS, of course, all these Cs are negative, but for the ISS models, you have the magnitude of CD is of order 10 to the minus 2. And that's not very good. But the generalized models all have CDs of order 1. So from this point of view, the ISS models fail, but the generalized model, once again, does pretty well from this point of view to solve the flavor problem. The second type of tuning is what we call the flavor tuning. We would naively want CD and COD, the off-diagonal elements of this matrix, to be the same order of magnitude. And that way we would call a solution to the flavor problem. Again, we can estimate what they are in terms of numbers we've calculated. This delta, this M0, our physical mass for the scalar, and MUV, the UV mass. And here I'm always assuming delta left equals delta right, because that's sort of the worst case scenario. And then from this, we can construct a measure for the tuning as the ratio of the off-diagonal to the diagonal mass, which is given in terms of delta, the IR contribution to the mass, and whatever physical mass we choose. And notice that this has no dependence on MUV. So this is independent of the first kind of tuning. And this tells us gives us a good measure of how much we actually have to tune UV to IR, IR, the UV to UV instead of the UV to IR. Okay? And from this formula, it turns out that even in the best case scenario, we can't really avoid tuning. If we look at the KK bar mixing and we take two cases, ISS with large Yukawa and the general model, the small Yukawa didn't work, didn't even try to work. The large Yukawa, we don't really trust, but for a moment, let's just say that, let's just believe it just for the sake of argument to see what we can do. And the general model seemed to be doing okay from all our other tests. We'll choose a value of M0. I picked this by, we know what the Gugino mass is, so I found what the value of M0 had to be in order to maximize, get right to the bound from those plots. I had the code to calculate those plots since I wrote the paper, so I was able to calculate what the maximum value of delta could be to still maintain the KK bar mixing bounds, and notice that it's always of order 0.1, so that's good. But even at the best case scenario, you see the tuning is roughly 3%. So this is a little unfortunate news. It doesn't look like it really is realized. Okay, so a couple of, just one or two more things. Something I haven't talked at all about, because it's probably very interesting and work in progress, is the Higgs sector of this model. It's quite complicated. It can be thought of as two hypermultiplets, so now you have four Higgs doublets rather than just two, and an N equals two Suzy model. So the superpotential looks like this funny mu term, and these new couplings between this first type of Higgs, this second type of Higgs, and these adjoints. So this looks like an N equals 2 hypermultiplet. And similarly, you can take all the ups and replace them with downs. The H superfields have R charge 0, and the R superfields have R charge 2. And the mu term is different, because remember, an ordinary mu term was forbidden by the R symmetry. So due to the super soft nature of this model, for those of you who know about that game, the Higgs D term vanishes in the limit that the soft masses for the adjoint scalars vanish, and that makes electroweak symmetry breaking difficult in general. Now, this problem is solved to some extent because the scalar masses, like I showed you before, at one loop they're generated and they're pretty big. So actually, you can integrate them out at a relatively high scale, and you will then lose the super soft nature of the theory. So the Gugino masses will once again start contributing to the running of the scalars, but only from the scale of the scalars to the scale of the Gugino. So it's the super soft picture, but only in a smaller window. Okay? Mu and B terms can be generated from UV operators. B term would come from an operator just like sort of what I wrote down for the scalars. And this would generate a B term of order MUV. And a mu term can also be generated by a UV operator that only involves one insertion of the spurion. And this would also generate a mu term of the same order. So except for the B term, the Higgs sector obeys a PQ symmetry. So that's new. Normally, in the MSSM, mu and B both violate the PQ symmetry. But here, because this R is different, the mu terms are preserved for PQ, and the B term does not. So that tells us that these operators have to be generated from different physics. And in particular, a mu term could actually be generated by gauge-mediated loops. So you can actually generate a mu term, but you still can't generate a b term because you have no spurion to break the pq symmetry. So this is something that we're actually working on right now, trying to figure out how to do that. Okay, one more interesting point. Ordinary gauge mediation, the Gravitino is the LSP, and it is here as well. The Gravitino mass goes like the F term over the Planck mass, which for everything we've been talking about, F is like 100 TeV, so this is 1 keV. So a paper just came out a few months ago by Cribbs, Martin, and Roy, where they studied the electroweak gauginos and higginos, the chargino-neutralino sector, and they found that in many regions of parameter space, the charginos are the NLSP, and they can actually have pretty long lifetimes. So all Suzy particles decay through a cascade involving the charged reno, which then only has a lower bound from left 2. This leads to potentially interesting new collider signals, and anyone is interested, I'd be happy to talk to them about it. But this is this paper by Cribbs, Martin, and Roy, which is very well written. Okay, so the MRSSM, a new class of Suzy models with some fascinating possibilities, I think. Besides a new and untried phenomenological model with these, it's still not realized in a lot of places. It's a great home for ISS-like models, as I showed you before. R-symmetric gauge mediations, a modified Suzy breaking mediator providing a new and unique spectrum, both from what it allows and also the nature of the mass spectrum itself. This mixture of super soft and the fact that it's a Dirac gaugino and gauge mediation makes it gives it a new topology and potentially very interesting. For RGM to realize MRSSM, it's possible, but it requires a better understanding of the UV theory. Right, the only way we were able to do it is to go to strong. The only way we were able to pretend to do it, I should say, is to go to very strong coupling. So that tells us that, at least in the perturbative regime, you can't generate this model, unfortunately, from ISS. The Higgs sector is really quite fascinating. The mu problem is solved, but the B problem is still open. Where does this come from? The Higgs sector, even at low energies, I don't know why I've said that, but okay, provides a rich environment for new physics due to these new n equals 2 couplings, those lambdas, and the pseudo-supersoft nature of the model. And this is work in progress that I'm doing right now with the grad student Santiago. And I'd be happy to talk to anyone who's interested in hearing what we're doing. Okay, thank you. Only 5 minutes over.
So can you repeat your solution to the new problem? I'm still...
Oh, the... I say that because you can actually... If you include a dimension, for example, if you include a dimension 4 operator in a superpotential, just from ordinary gauge mediated things, so you have R up, H up, phi bar phi, or some scale, right? This operator will generate a mu term like so. So at one loop you generate a mu term that's the right size in gauge mediation. So that's all I mean when I say we solve the mu term. And you can think of this as either maybe you've integrated out a scale, a singlet, or it's the first higher dimension operator you can write down that we haven't done. So, however, you can do anything like this for the B term, right? Because the B, you can think of that as the B term already has a PQ symmetry. So just by a spurion analysis, there's no loops you can write down that will generate such a thing. Ordinarily, ordinarily in any Suzy, of course, mu also breaks the PQ symmetry. So you wouldn't be able to do anything like this. But because of the different form of the symmetry, it's...
And there's another, isn't there another sort of mu type problem in all of these models, and that there's no a priori reason why the UV and the IR contribution, Suzy breaking masses, should be anywhere the same? but they are up to, you choose them to be up to a factor of 5 or whatever you want. So isn't that another mu type problem that these models have?
The
and you have some, the UV ones are controlled by this scale lambda, which is some UV scale.
Yeah.
And well, the IR ones are controlled by gauge couplings and some F term, so
right.
It seems like they would have no reason to be the same a priori.
Yes. To the fact that we chose lambda to be lambda 3 over 4 pi and a messenger to be 100 TeV gives you the right numbers.
So coincidentally, you're saying if you choose the Landau pole, choose that to be the scale lambda, then it works.
Then it works. So you're right that there is. But this is...
I mean, that Landau pole doesn't have anything to do with the couplings between the hidden and the visible sector. It's not clear that the couplings have to be that big. But
right. Well, this is... Right. So this operator, this lambda is not the lambda from before. This would be like, say, M of a scalar or something like that. So I just call it lambda because I'm being sloppy. But so, yeah, if you plug in like the messenger mass scale around for this.
That lambda is or isn't related to lambda 3.
Right. Yeah, I should. Let me not call it lambda. Let me call it M. Let's call it M. So it's something that presumably lives around the same place as lambda. With some physics you've integrated out.
The fact that you can write down such an operator doesn't, it's not exactly what I would call a solution to the new problem.
Well,
I mean, is this kind of operator generated in, say, the ISS or whatever solutions that...
Well, if you have... If you have, for example, you can generate it if you, for example, had a singlet.
Oh, I agree.
Right.
So,
but yeah, so.
So you're going to go to a singlet model to actually get this. All right, well.
So, all right, so you
have both.
you agree on side of people at solution. I guess I've been hearing a lot of everyone saying, you know, Natty Seiberg wrote a paper that says that gauge mediation can never generate the mu term. I was thinking, okay, well, here we turn it. It's allowed, right? We wrote it down.
Any other questions or comments? Sure. Let's thank Andrew again.